Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Earth Day, Tuesday, April 22nd, 2014, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-host, Lavendar and Anastasia. Tonight, we're presenting again from Lavendar's vault her story of some of the galactic demonstrations which were orchestrated by the Pleiadians to train her in the ways the ETs can interact in 3D. This will lead up to another story which shows us that they always have a backup plan in case of emergency, as in the life and death of actress Natalie Wood. We also have many hours of shows from Lavendar's Vault in our archives, which our newer listeners probably haven't heard, so you'll get a chance to get caught up with those when we go on our Crystal Quest, since we'll be off the air for those 2 weeks, and that's the week before Pleiadian lineup and the week after. We'll be sending invitations soon for the September 21 through 27 quest, and we've already taken some reservations for the fall. So if you have 25, 26, 27 degrees in any of these signs, Taurus, Scorpio, Cancer, Capricorn, Aquarius, or Leo, you have the rites of passage to participate. And you can just send an email to crystals@starseedhotline.com for more details. At the top of the show, it's the Starseed News segment with Anastasia, bringing topics of interest to Starseed and sharing some emails from our listeners. We'd like to thank Fiona and Claudia for hosting the switchboard this evening, and you can call in to listen on 917-889-8292. We also have an online community at starseedhotline.ning.com, and we'd like to thank Tammy for her help and dedication to the forum. Starseed Hotline's toll-free number is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, you can find out how to make the most of your 10 hours of power by requesting your solar return timing. So I would like to introduce Anastasia first this evening. So, Anastasia, welcome. Hello.
Hi. Good evening, everybody. I hope you are all well this beautiful Earth Day, April 22nd. It's good to be with you today. Always good to be with you, Arielle, and all of our Starseed listeners and all of you beautiful people at the switchboard and Lavendar. It's just one of my – I just so enjoy being with you every week. And, boy, the weeks sure fly by, don't they?
They are.
So we're gonna, it's just whisking away. But we'll start tonight's news with news from spaceweather.com. That's a nice little website. But they say that there is now a waning chance of solar storms. NOAA forecasters have downgraded the chance of geomagnetic storms today to 35%, as they say Earth is exiting a stream of high-speed solar wind. So it's tempering down a little bit. And as today is Earth Day, we are also having a meteor shower because Earth is passing through a stream of debris from the ancient comet Thatcher, which is the source of the annual Lyrid meteor shower. Now, Professor Peter Brown of the University of Western Ontario reports that the Canadian Meteor Orbit Radar just finished processing orbital data from last night, and the Lyrids are showing up quite nicely. The meteor rate is about 15 meteors per hour, so visual observers should have had a good view early this morning and should be able to easily detect the meteor shower tonight. So that'll be fun. If you don't have clouds in the sky, go out and spend some time watching falling stars. And don't forget to make a wish, several wishes. The more meteors you find, the more wishes you can make.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a great thing to do. Well, a dramatic change, everybody, is coming to the Chilean coast mountain range of Cerro Amazonas, because in a few weeks, the 10,000-foot mountain is going to have its top knocked right off. 10,000-foot mountain, and they're going to take its top off. Why? Well, they're going to build the world's biggest telescope right there. Now, they say that is a place to really see the stars as no other place on the planet. And when completed, this so-called European Extremely Large Telescope, or E-ELT, and its 39-meter mirror will allow astronomers to peer further into space and look further back into the history of the universe than any other astronomical device in existence. They are excited about that. Now, they say it's going to be very challenging to make this enormous mirror. This was an article that I took from The Guardian, and it was, gosh, it was a long article. I have condensed it because they went into all of the information on the mechanics of making a space mirror, but it should be pretty exciting. They are, astronomers are all worked up about that. So that's going to be really interesting in a few years when they get that built and they can give us reports. So let's keep our eyes on that kind of news. It'll take a while. It's going to take a long time, actually. And there was a space fireball from space exploded over a Russian city on the 19th of April, just a few days ago. They say that a suspected meteorite explosion was recorded by citizens of the northern Russian city of Murmansk. And they say that multiple drivers that had dash cams out on the streets, they were out driving around. By the way, it's a 300,000 population city. They noticed a bright blue trail across the night sky, and then it exploded while still in the air. Now, I saw those videos on the Internet, and that was one impressive fireball, very impressive. In Scotland, we don't hear much about Scotland, but Scotland had a massive power blackout just the other day. In fact, late last week, I think it was on, I don't know, the end of the week sometime. But 200,000 homes in northern Scotland lost power, left almost a third of the country in darkness, and they say it was incredibly severe. They're just not accustomed to that. For them, they claim that their power efficiency and reliability is 99.9%. They say that the precise cause of the problem remains unknown. They're considering a number of scenarios, but it affected communities over a 44,000 square kilometer area. And in Slovenia, Italy, yet again in Europe, there was another earthquake last week. It happened near a nuclear plant. It was a 4.4 magnitude, and they don't really know much more about that, except that it shook about 200 kilometers from a nuclear power plant in a town in eastern Slovenia. So that's been happening. Slovenia, excuse me. And there was a second earthquake in 24 hours recorded in Rutland, UK. This also came from The Guardian. A second 3.5 earthquake struck the UK 24 hours after the first one, which is a 3.3 magnitude quake that shook houses for around 10 seconds. Now, the British Geological Survey said it was unexpected for there to be a second earthquake in exactly the same location. And Papua New Guinea is still rocking and rolling. Just about every darn day they're having an earthquake. They had a 6.9 just a few days ago. And in Mexico, on Friday, a 7.5 earthquake shook that town up pretty good. It shook central and southern Mexico. The U.S. Geological Survey said it was centered northwest of the Pacific Resort of Acapulco. And the quake was felt strongly in Mexico City, but they say there were no immediate reports of injuries or damage. Now, it shook for at least 30 seconds. They say that buildings swayed as people fled high-rises and took to the streets. So they also said that the quake center was 30 miles deep, so that was pretty deep. But, wow, caused a lot of panic, they say, in the streets of Mexico City. Okay. Now, on the Kamchatka, I'm going to learn to speak all these languages, and then I'll do this with great finesse, because now I'm speaking Russian. I'll bet you didn't know I was speaking Russian, but Kamchatka Peninsula, there are five volcanoes erupting at once. Now, this place, the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia, has a lot of active volcanoes, or recently active volcanoes, 113 to be exact, and 40 of those volcanoes are now active. They are either erupting or capable of erupting on a short notice. They discovered this through the operational land imager on Landsat 8, and recently it captured a lot of activity what should I say, non-dormant activity at five of them during a single satellite pass just a couple of weeks ago. That's a very active ring of, it's not the ring of fire, but it's a very active volcanic area there in Russia. And a massive sinkhole opened up in Burlington, Iowa, around 7 feet deep. It appeared on a main road in Burlington last week. Officials say a 2-inch hole in an underground pipe. They say it was a water main break that caused the sinkhole. Now, you know, this is happening a lot everywhere all over the country, and at the very least, it sure indicates deteriorating infrastructure here in the States, because a lot of people are claiming that water main breaks are causing sinkholes. And there was also, this is sort of off the cuff here, I don't have it in my news piece here, but I just wanted to remind you or tell you about a sinkhole in Florida just came out in yesterday's news. It was so huge. It was swallowing two very large houses in an area of Florida called the Villages. So just a lot of sinkholes happening all over the country. And in central Idaho, there were hundreds of earthquakes that have been striking there. There's a swarm since last month. And it began on March 25th, and it was climaxed by a 4.9 magnitude tremor on Saturday. Now, it's produced no reports of injuries or severe damage, but it sure has rattled people's nerves. They say that Saturday's quake was the strongest on record since 2005, and it was followed on Monday, yesterday, by a magnitude 4.4 quake that struck 10 miles north of the small ranching community of Challis, Idaho. And this is according to the U.S. Geological Survey. And again, in England, in the area of Rutland, there was a 3.2 magnitude earthquake, which was felt up to 25 miles away from the town of Oakham, Rutland, and it was recorded at a depth of 2.5 miles. And in Bellamy Islands, which was felt over New Zealand and Australia just last Thursday, there was an earthquake that was a magnitude of 6.2. So a lot of earthquake activity all over the world, in areas where they're rare and not expected, and in the areas where they are expected and frequent, they've been really a pretty large kinds of quakes going on, over 6 point, many of them near 7. Well, scientists have discovered that Earth has a twin. This is out of the New York Times, and the twin is called Planet Kepler-186f, and that is the first Earth-sized planet found in the habitable zone. Now, it's a bit bigger and colder than our planet, but it is a planet that's circling a star 500 light years away, and it's the closest match of our home so far discovered. Astronomers announced this on Thursday. They say that it has a diameter of 8,700 miles, 10% wider than Earth, and its orbit lies within what they call the Goldilocks zone. Now, that's the orbit of its own star where it can support life, and that star is called Kepler-186. It's similar to our sun. They say that puts it in a range that's not too hot and not too cold, where temperatures can allow for liquid water to come to the surface, making it potentially hospitable for life. Now, Kepler-186f is the first validated Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone of another star, and this came from a spokesman of the SETI Institute. And they announced this at a news conference on Thursday. They say that it has just the right size and is at the right distance to have properties similar to our home planet. Oh, it would be so cool to go there and see what that's like.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that amazing? It is. You know, not too many years ago, when I was young, people were saying there was nothing like Earth. So we really have come a long way in science. They are finding Earth-type planets all over the place, or similar, new planets, all kinds of things they're finding. So that's really very, very interesting. Now, I'll bet you think that your nose is the only thing in your body that can smell. I know I did till I read this article. This is out of PBS and Starseed Barbara. I had no idea about any of this stuff. But they say that our sense of smell, scientists are discovering, is far more complicated than we'd ever imagined. Now, it's not just confined to our noses. Scientists are finding scent receptors throughout our bodies. In the last 10 years, reports indicate that smell receptors, besides those that we find on our taste buds, crop up. But did you know we have smell receptors on our taste buds? Because we do.
Right, yeah.
I wanted to just point that out. But they say that these crop up all over our bodies. In 2003, scientists found bitter taste receptors in sperm. And that very same year, they came across scent receptors in the kidneys and in the spine. And other papers done by researchers have indicated, and this just followed later, you know, in the last few years, have reported these receptors in the bladder and in the gut, and that we have bitter receptors in the sinuses, airways, pancreas, and brain, and scent receptors in, guess what, the muscle tissue. Wow, we could talk a long time about that. That's very holistic.
What a concept.
Is that a concept?
Yeah,
a purpose. But when you think about that, you can really kind of expand your consciousness around that. This indicates that we are so far more, have far more capability to be attuned to our environment than we would have ever imagined. Because after all, human beings are animals. And as we kind of consider how tame and domesticated we've become, and the sort of out of touch we've become with the earth and the planet, that we have far more abilities to sense and anticipate our environment than we're probably anywhere near aware of. And that's really pretty far out. Well, this story came from you, Ariel. Thank you very much. But this is about organic lines of foods. And Walmart and Wild Oats are teaming up. The world's largest retailer has teamed up with Wild Oats to sell a new line of organic food that's at least 25% cheaper than the national organic brands. So those of you that like organic foods, like myself, it's going to be available, so they say, at a deeper discount than probably major organic food stores. And there has been a groundbreaking discovery announced by researchers at Tel Aviv University. They have found something that may eventually render bypass surgery obsolete, because they have shown that an injected protein can regrow blood vessels in the human heart. Researchers have developed a protein-based injection that, when delivered straight into the muscles of the body, they will spark the regrowth of tiny blood vessels. This is amazing. This has implications in so many conditions. They say that new blood vessels in the heart, of course, would give millions of people around the world a brand new lease on life. And they say that if they can raise the money, they're hoping that toxicity studies and phase one trials could be complete within just 2 years. So, wow. I mean, when you just kind of step back and look at everything that's happening in science and astronomy and medicine and all of the advancements and the things that we're discovering, it's just going so fast. What's the world going to be like 50 years from now with all of the things they're uncovering? It's just an amazing time to be alive. It really is. Well, that's going to be it for tonight's news, Ariel. I'm looking forward to the show.
Well, as are we. And, yeah, I'm still kind of reeling about the implications of all the advancements. If only our spiritual consciousness can keep up.
Right.
Star seeds don't have much of a problem with that, but as a race, it's imperative that we keep our spiritual advancement and unfolding at a equal par with the technological advances.
You're so right. It makes you wonder, when that sort of wave hits, that's going to be an amazing thing to see. If we can see mass consciousness get elevated to catch up, we're all hoping for that, and we're waiting. We're all waiting, aren't we?
We're not only waiting, but we're contributing.
Yes, well, yes, that's
true,
of course.
Everybody adds a spoonful into the bucket.
A spoonful into the bucket, that's right. Yes, sir. Well, we will meet again next week.
Okay, Anastasia, thank you so much for the news. You found some really good, interesting stuff, and I'm just amazed at all the changes that are going on around the world and in the places where people are being affected by the earth changes. We just need to send the up spiral light and energy of healing to those areas.
Absolutely.
Thank you for those targets. And next I'm going to introduce Lavendar. And Anastasia, thank you so much, and happy Earth Day. Lavendar, you have, first of all, welcome to the show. I know you have something that you want to share before we go into the feature of our show.
Yes. Someone sent me, in fact, her name is Catherine, and she sent me something in regards to the crossing of Belva Bloomer. I'd like to read this email. Dear Lavendar, the presence of Belva became so strong while I listened this evening to your beautiful memorial tribute that I just had to take a moment to connect. It felt as if her silence was filling the room and sinking into my heart. Since she was so instrumental in the Giza crystals, I wanted to share my strangely wonderful experience with them in her honor. It was my birthday in 2012, and while I was quietly reading, I happened to look down and there was a little Giza crystal on my foot. I reached over to pick it up and it disappeared. Poof! A few minutes went by and I happened to look down again and there was another Giza crystal sitting on my foot. I tried really fast this time to swoop it up, but poof! It was gone. I sat there wondering for a few minutes and then saw a little stream of light coming from the carpet next to my foot. This time, when I swooped down, I picked up a little crystal bead. In my hand, the bead became bigger and then smaller. Whoa! A few minutes later, another little stream of light from the carpet, another swoop, and yet another little crystal bead in my hand. I thought this one would disappear completely because it became so small. To this day, I wear them wired onto a sacred geometry pendant that I wear 24/7. What a wonderful birthday present. Thank you, Belva and Lavendar. As a side, a few days later, I saw my first ship as it hovered over my house. I can't say if that's related. There it was in broad daylight, shining as can be, just hanging out a few hundred feet over the trees in the backyard. Since then, I've seen about 75 to 100 ships. Of course, that's another story along with how they taught me to communicate with them. Just thought I would share that last bit with you, as in my reading in 2010, you said you had a feeling I might have contact. I wanted nothing to do with contact at that time, but let's just say that things have changed. Thank you for the heartfelt memorial. It allowed many of us to feel her presence along with a connection, although we've never met in this lifetime. With a melting heart, love and light, Catherine. I just wanted to share that because it really touched me. In fact, all of the emails that I've received this past week concerning our tribute to Belva, thank you so much. You listeners are just wonderful about responding to things that you hear on our show. And it's because of you. All of you Starseed keeps me going. Thank you. Okay, back to you, Ariel, for the show.
Okay. Yeah, I actually had a couple of emails, too, concerning last week's show. And truly, everyone that listens to the show is connected to Belva. She's like the grandma to all of us. So we really appreciate the acknowledgement. So we have some things from your vault this evening, and there's going to be two pieces. The first is some stories about galactic demonstrations that you went through. And even though maybe at the time you were just barely hanging on, but you made it through and learned what they were trying to show you. And then that leads up to this story of how they always have a backup plan, as explained in your story concerning Natalie Wood. And I will just go ahead and start that now.
I returned to Giant Rock many times after that mysterious February 7th, 1977 trip. If you haven't heard the long version of Crack Between the Worlds episode, maybe you need to go back and listen to it so it'll be in context with the rest of this story. At least, you know, I was down at Giant Rock maybe once a week for months. I was included in discussions about the Integraton. Then the government came and told George to stop allowing people to go inside. They actually had agents that stayed on top of the hill with binoculars monitoring George, Doris, and everyone that came to visit them. Everybody that showed up, well, they got on a list to be observed for later. I think that shutting down the Integraton was one of the reasons George decided to leave the planet. The people in the consciousness of 1977 couldn't accept what this machine was truly about. One of the things I remembered the most is the day George took me to Giant Rock and pointed at it and said, "You know, one day Giant Rock's going to crack, and when it does, you're going to have to release this information." And I said, "What information?" And at that point, something came over him, and that's when I got the information. I will discuss more of that later, or you can go back and hear that in Crack Between the Worlds. Things that were so beyond my comprehension, the truth about walk-ins, time travel, rejuvenation, cloning, just all of it. It was almost like he was on a speed dial. Then he would see when I was overloading, and we'd just walk for a while before continuing. I need to tell a story here, although it's out of order of things and events, but this is the place I need to tell it, because it's very important to this story. I'll jump ahead a few years. In 1981, I was in direct contact with my spaceship, Star of Bethlehem. Thurman Myers, the man I was with at the time, well, we left Las Vegas and we were on our way to New Mexico. I began hearing a communication from the ship. We were directed to stop and go by Sedona into Oak Creek Canyon. I was told to find a little cabin to rent because I needed a quiet place to write and work and continue these ET demonstrations. We were driving up and down this road looking for a place to rent when all of a sudden, in front of some cabins that were closed for the season, there stood George Van Tassel on the side of the road. He was just standing there grinning. Thurman saw him, and then I saw him, and I yelled, "Well, that's George! George Van Tassel, turn around, now!" He turned around, and of course George wasn't there anymore. But he had been standing in front of a sign of this place that said closed. I said, "This is the place. We're going to rent it." I think the name of it was the Chipmunk Inn or something like that. Thurman said, "You're not going to rent this place. It's shut down." I told him that we had to find the owner and make a deal, which we did, and we rented the cabin for 3 months. We both had seen George, but what was so ironic about this is that it was 1981 and George had died in February of 78. During those months, I journaled many, many transmissions that I was receiving from the ship. What I came to find out from some of these galactic gems of wisdom is that since the very moment I was born, I've been monitored and I've been guided by the Star of Bethlehem, my ship. My whole life experience is and has been an experiment that I myself was part of planning before I was born. I was chosen for this experiment because of who I'd been and what I had become through my evolution. I simply had to walk the walk, talk the talk, and live right through it. And that's what I came to know. On New Year's Eve of 1978, Gina Bilodeau, Jeanette Browning, and I went to see a movie called The Turning Point with Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft. I remembered seeing Shirley on the screen, and I felt like I knew her. It was like somebody was giving me signals about her. There was an extraordinary feeling I had, and after seeing her on screen, I started having flashes about her. These flashes were indications of her future metaphysical interest and concern about UFOs. The information that I was receiving was being directed from above. I was being prepared for the future of my association with her. Remember that she was part of the Rat Pack with Sinatra, as she was the female member. But I actually wouldn't get to meet her in person until later in the early 80s. I'd like to refer now to a time that happened in Oklahoma City in September of 78. I decided to have some rebirthing sessions with a lady named Polly Estep. I had gone to the bookstore and picked up a book about Nostradamus. And I was waiting for her to show up. I was sitting on her doorstep, and I was thumbing through this book. And all of a sudden, I had this experience. About this time, Pope Paul VI had died, and they had appointed a new pope, John Paul I. Sitting there, I just got tuned in, and I knew that this pope was going to be killed, and I got very agitated. I don't know if it had anything to do with Nostradamus or not, but when Polly showed up, I just couldn't have a session. I had to get in my car and just drive home. Within 2 days, Pope Paul I was dead. The official story of John Paul's sudden death, who served only 33 days as pope, was caused by, they say, a common heart attack. However, a degree of uncertainty accompanied this diagnosis because there was never an autopsy performed. The discrepancies in the Vatican account of the events surrounding John Paul's death, its inaccurate statements about who found the body, what he'd been reading, what he'd found in the vault, everything about it was suspicious. There were so many conspiracies going on at that time about the Vatican Bank and who owned the shares of money. Even fiction focused on the bizarre death of the Pope. The movie The Godfather Part 3 featured a major plotline depicting the Vatican Bank involved in organized crime, with various intrigues resulting in the assassination of a Pope, openly named in the movie as John Paul I. And there's so many theories about the CIA assassination attempt due to John Paul I being perceived as trying to improve ties with the Soviet Union in his removal of several pro-American clergy. We'll probably never know for sure whether or not Pope John Paul I was killed, but I tend to believe the information that I was receiving from the ship at the time. Things seemed to be accelerating for me in 1978. I met Thurman Myers, my new man, who I'd be with for 10 years. I took him to Giant Rock to meet Doris. As I had mentioned earlier, George had died in February, and after that trip I became very sick. My colon was messed up with polyps, and I was burned out and tired. I was hardly working at my business anymore. I did have 3 clients who worked at the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino. I kept seeing a fire at the MGM Grand and people dying. I told my 3 clients that if they didn't change jobs, they could die in a fire. They didn't listen, and when the fire happened, they died. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. I quit. I was not doing readings anymore. You know, many years later, I was involved in a product that we all went to Las Vegas to try to get put together through a company called Beyond Sea, and I got to meet a man who had been in charge of the MGM, and if he had made certain decisions, that fire never would have happened. I actually got to work with him, and we talked about the fire, and I helped him with the transmutation of his guilt. So that was many years later. So back to my trip to Sarasota, Florida. That's where I went to recover from my burnout. Thurman went to Indonesia and left me there in Sarasota by myself. My mother came to stay with me while he was gone, and during her visit, I started having incredible pains in my stomach area. She called an ambulance, and I was rushed to the hospital where they thought that I had a kidney stone. I'd already been told, and not by doctors, but by them, that I should not have sodium pentothal. When I told the doctors that I couldn't have sodium pentothal, they asked me why. And I said, because I'm a UFO contactee. They thought I was a nutcase. They wheeled me into the operating room where they were going to extract what they thought was a kidney stone. Ironically, one of the nurses in the operating room with me was the sister of my hairdresser. She told me later that when they administered the anesthesia, and she didn't know whether it was pentothal or not, that my heart stopped. She said that they were about to put the defibrillator paddle on me to revive me when a blue light filled the room and a voice said, "Don't touch her." They started backing away as bizarreness had entered the room and everyone fled to huddle in the hall to regroup. When they returned, my heart had started beating again, and they proceeded to remove something they couldn't identify, as it was not a kidney stone. I'm sure now that it was an implant of some kind. When I woke up in recovery, there were these 3 men in black at the foot of my bed asking me questions. I later found out that this doctor had had an affair with a woman involved in UFO phenomena who was trying to get $500,000 out of him. It started to make more sense why he was acting this way when he told my mother back in the room that I needed psychiatric help. The doctor wrote these prescriptions and handed them to the nurse to call in. She gave the paper back to my mother afterwards, so I got to keep them to see exactly what they were. When I started taking the pills, they wigged me out. They were actually making me crazy. I got into a fight with my mother, who left in tears and flew home. But when she got home, she got her medical book out, read up on these drugs, and called me. She told me to stop taking the stuff. She read that when you take these drugs together, they do create psychotic episodes, and you can go crazy. She saved my life from this demon doctor who was trying to kill me, or at least make me literally crazy. In December of 1979, Thurman asked me where I wanted to go for my birthday, and I told him that I wanted to go to Aruba. We went to Aruba, where I enjoyed it very much. I would eventually live there for a while, but more on that later. By January of 1980, I was in Cripple Creek, Colorado, looking at an A-frame house that Thurman had bought for us. We still had the place in Sarasota, so I flew back and forth from Cripple Creek to Sarasota from time to time. I could only stay about 3 weeks at a time in Cripple Creek because of the altitude. I was in Sarasota when my father decided to come to visit. I was driving to the airport to pick him up in my Lincoln convertible. I was crossing the Sarasota Bridge when I saw a single cloud in the sky. About the time I saw the cloud, lightning came out of it and struck the bridge. It bounced off the bridge and hit me in the car. I was driving this Lincoln convertible with the top down. Anyway, I stopped the car and heard the man behind me slap on his brakes, and I heard the sound of cars running into each other one after another. They didn't hit me, but I was sitting behind the wheel with my fingers clamped on the steering wheel. The man, who was behind me, ran up to my car, asked if I wanted to go to the hospital. And I said, "Oh no, I have to pick up my daddy from the airport. I have to see my daddy." I just gunned the car, speeded toward the airport, which was a couple of miles away. I remembered looking back in the rearview mirror, wondering what people were thinking and what were they going to tell the police when they arrived. I decided not to be there for any of it. When my dad got off the plane, he'd been drinking. I tried to explain to him what had happened to me, but he didn't care. He was totally unconcerned. All he wanted to know is if I had any girlfriends he could meet and to party with. Who was this man? I had never seen such behavior coming from him. I was glad to put him back on the plane after a week from Daddy from Hell. Thurman came back from Indonesia, and he started treating me really bad. I wondered what I was doing to deserve this terrible treatment. To counteract the treatment that I was receiving from Thurman, I decided I was going to help him. By helping him, I would help myself and do the things that I needed to accomplish. Besides, I had the ship with me and my Galactic Secret Service. We went through several experiences where he saw the kind of galactic powers that were standing and walking with me. He really snapped one day when we got on a train in Albuquerque. I didn't want to get on the train. I felt like that something really bad was going to happen. But he made me get on it anyway. We went to the club car, and he started drinking. Thurman got into a fight with the bartender who had been on this train for years. In fact, the bartender was on his way to Chicago, where he was actually retiring at the end of the trip. This was, of course, his last trip. Anyway, security had to come and put Thurman in our bunk, where I started undressing him. As I was taking his clothes off, I started hearing a voice that said, "In the wheels, in the wheels, in the wheels." I thought, "My God, I've got to get off this train, and I'm just going to leave Thurman on it. I'm getting off." I was so disgusted with him. I asked the conductor where the next stop was, and he told me that it was Dodge City, Kansas. When the train stopped, I had my bags in my hand ready to depart. As I stepped off the train, I heard this voice say, "Get Thurman off the train. You can't leave him here." I said, "I don't want him." And a voice said, "Take him off the train." The voice kept yelling at me. So with the help of this energy, we dressed him and got him off the train. He was a very big man. So it was really, I don't know how I got him dressed and off the train. So there we were, standing at the station at midnight. Thurman was drunk, no cabs, no one around, and I didn't know where we were going to go. Then out of the blue, this man pulled up and asked if we needed a ride someplace, and I asked if he could take us to a motel. The man found us a motel, and we thanked him. I've often wondered who that man really was. The next morning when we got up, something just said, "Turn on that TV." And on the news was a story about the train that we'd been on crashing in Lawrence, Kansas, and killing all those people in the Pullman where we'd been sleeping. It was completely demolished. And the bartender? He was killed on his last shift. Thurman looked at me, and he snapped big time. I really didn't have much trouble with Thurman and his drinking after that. It was a turning point, because then, I guess, well, he felt like he owed his life to me. For 2 years after that, though, a galactic female, an extraterrestrial energy, came and worked with him through me. There was another episode where a man tried to come into our hotel room with a knife. We were down in the Cayman Islands at the time. When I stood up, the knife flew out of his hand and scared him so bad that he ran out of the room. Thurman was sitting there and asked, "How did I do that?" I told him I didn't do it, that the beings with me must have knocked the knife away. So this was just another example of the Galactic Secret Service. Here's another example of Thurman not wanting to listen. I told him that we were not going to get on this particular airplane. We were in Florida, I think at Miami Airport. And he said, "No, we're getting on this airplane." We argued back and forth, and as I refused to get on the flight, the argument, well, it just became a waste of breath and energy, because the plane got grounded. The pilot said that they had never seen anything like it. There was fog inside the windshield. All these strange things that happened were actually about training Thurman in stopping that Dark Lord crap that he was carrying with him. He was into power and control. "You'll do what I tell you to do, or else." Well, all that stopped. I was being monitored the whole time I was with Thurman because he could be dangerous with his "you'll do what I tell you" routine. He started calming down after several of these demonstrations, but it took some extreme examples to get him to pay attention. These demonstrations were so prolific that Thurman actually stopped drinking. He stayed sober the rest of the time that I was with him.
And now we are going to move on to Natalie Wood, Catalina, 1981.
December 29th, 1984, at 5:05 p.m., Glorieta, New Mexico. Shirley MacLaine. Now where do I begin? Our meeting, I guess, was destined to be. I had known that my path would not only cross Shirley's, but that somehow we would have many experiences together. For years, I'd been flashing about her, but nothing of any real significance. I'd smile with my brain when I'd read about her in the tabloids, but that was about it. My real knowing about Shirley started in Las Vegas, Nevada, somewhere between 1977 and 78. I'd pick up an article about her, and as I read it, I knew that we would come together with a meeting of the minds. Little did I know at the time that in the near future, it would be related to something that I would call War of the Minds. At that point of my life, I was living and working in Las Vegas. What a town. Whatever you wanted or even think that you wanted, you could have in 10 minutes. The town truly never shuts down. After spending 5 years there, I learned that the highest of souls and the lowest of souls were gathered there. Huge ET experiment. It seemed to be a place where great transmutations would happen, that accelerated evolution would take place. In Las Vegas. As I already mentioned, in the summer of 75, I was one of 7 people who had an extraterrestrial experience out at Lake Mead. We watched aliens walk on the water. None of us were ever the same after that event. Our lives really changed drastically. I'd already had several ET contacts, but I can look back and see that this particular encounter seemed to set my feet on a path of great evolutionary experiences. As I've mentioned earlier, I was conducting counseling work by using astrological charts. I utilized my psychic abilities more than the science of astrology, which always kind of made other astrologers about half nuts. At that time, I knew about my double pineal, But on the other hand, I really didn't know or would comprehend to know for many years later what that really meant about how the ETs would come and go from my double pineal. The Lake Mead experience accelerated my abilities. It seemed that my sight, hearing, and all of my other senses were just amped up about 1,000-fold. People started coming to counseling at an accelerated rate. I didn't know it then, but I had an ET that came and worked with me every single day. Their work was handled on the QT because it wasn't time for them to make their everyday physical appearance in my life. I suppose that I was just too green or too emotionally crippled from all of my romantic adventures to handle extraterrestrials on an everyday basis. I suppose that I had to hang on to suffering a little while longer before they made their entrance to me. There is one real valuable lesson that I learned from my space brothers and sisters, and that is, they know what is happening to us, and they are matching it with cosmic timing the whole time that we're doing our little Earth dance. You know, people would come to me by word of mouth, and I was always booked. For 3 years, I had no set fee, only donations. But after I started working with more cosmic laws, I discovered that the flow of exchange is necessary to do the best job and also be free of karmic ties. I lived with the flow of abundance, but nothing that you would call extravagant. When I wanted to be extravagant, I would just visit some movie star friend or people with a lot of Leo planets. Money for the sake of money has never really meant much to me. I suppose that is why I have so little respect for it. I observed in my counseling sessions what part money played in people's lives, and I finally figured out that people played the money game because at the end of their life, they could count all their toys, and whoever had the most toys upon death won the game. I suppose that reasoning warped my sense of values and led me to believe that money can truly burn a hole in your pocket. And besides, whoever saw a hearse with a luggage rack on top? Okay, so, yet when I left my practice in Vegas, I left with a man who was financially secure from his father's oil trust fund. And by this time, I was physically ill, mentally exhausted, and spiritually drained. I had locked into heavy judgment, could see people's potential, tried to help them, only see some of them crash and burn. Truly burn. Judgment is really, I think, what made me sick. I can see that now. I had gained an enormous amount of weight, had polyps in my colon, and I couldn't go to the bathroom without an enema. So, for 3 years. So, when Thurman came into my life, I was ready to leave that life and pick up a new one. I had a celestial visitation from a female energy that asked me if I would help on an assignment of transmuting a person to a higher level of being. And I said yes before I really had time to evaluate what I have to do in such an assignment. The first 3 years were very difficult and trying to my soul. Thurman knew how to drink and act ugly and play with people's minds and emotions. He knew nothing of metaphysics or cosmic laws. This was not an easy assignment, especially with a mouth like mine, which was, you know, my mouth gets like a torn pocket. I would go to my ET female friend and beg to be relieved of this assignment, and she'd be sitting in my other pineal talking to me as one would speak on the telephone, and I would yell, "I quit," and she'd say, "Not now." She actually would sit on my head and would literally paralyze my tongue when she knew that I had taken all the abuse I could stand. If she hadn't been there 24 hours a day, I would have left in the first month of torture. She kept telling me that Thurman was a very high being who had lost his way through many incarnations in flesh. She wanted me to bring him to his awareness so that he would remember who he was and why he was here. If I could turn his life around and put his feet firmly on the path, then I too would benefit through exalted, multi-level experiences. She reminded me of my past history of giving up on projects just because I got bored or just couldn't see things to completion. She told me that if I could stay to the end of this project, the reason that I'm mentioning about all this, about Thurman, is because it's important to understand our relationship, and our work and our pledge to the welfare of the planet. There have been many people come and go out of our lives in these last 6 years who have tried to get us apart for one reason or another, but they never seem to grasp or understand galactic pacts that are made with millions of souls hanging in the balance. Cosmic agreements are very serious, for they affect not only a root race that is vanishing, but a new root race that is now being prepared to come to Earth for the new age of reason. This all relates to other regions of space that are of a higher cosmic order. So needless to say that family, friends, etc. could have so little an influence upon such a cosmic project. Now as to the meeting of Shirley MacLaine, I must start with the months previous to our official meeting because it shows the integral workings of invisible forces that are at work that are trying to bring us together, while another force is trying to keep us apart. On November 1st, 1981, I was informed by galactic sources that a great wave of feminine energy was being brought to the planet. This energy would hit the cells residing in female bodies and strengthen it, thus causing some women to go overboard and lose their balance. Others would take the same energy and move through it and make it part of their lives forever. Not all women reacted the same to this energy. I remember feeling extremely charged and how difficult it was to close my eyes to even sleep that whole month of November. I can recall pulling my energies back from Thurman and from most male energies at the time. There was a few days that I'd awake thinking that men in general were the enemy. What was really happening was an alignment of energies in my own physical body that was to bring my male and female energies to some sort of balance. I think that this energy gets periodically active at different times of the year and causes some women to go just right off. With menopause, the pill, hormone imbalances, pollution, and sonic disturbance, who can really pinpoint these times unless one is in total balance and can home right in on these restructuring days for women? No medical person would ever step forward and agree with me as to what is happening to the women of the world. They'd be laughed at, right? I was told that I was to send quartz crystals to Cairo, Egypt, and they would go inside the pyramid to be charged with energies that would match this feminine energy shot that was being beamed to the planet. I was unable to go, but I sent Elizabeth Ellis, a beautiful star maiden, to be responsible for the crystals. From the moment I took the assignment about those crystals until the assignment was over, I was under heavy bombardment from dark forces not wanting these crystals to be charged with this feminine energy. One hassle after another occurred from November 1 to November 9, the day the crystals got on their way to Cairo. After I delivered the crystals to Elizabeth at the airport, I flew to Catalina Island, where we had rented a house for 3 months. I remembered crying most of the way. I was tired. I was suffering from psychic attack, frequency discernment, and physically and mentally exhausted. I was a wreck for 3 days, but after a brief rest, I continued my work doing transmissions from the spacecraft called the Star of Bethlehem, or some refer to it as TX-11. This is the same ship that helped during the time of the Essenes in Israel and was visible the night that Jesus was born of earthly flesh upon the planet. This same entity comes and goes now off the ship, but he goes now by another name, and some people know him as Sananda, and others give him other names for different times. And TX-11 is the new term given for the new age of reason. I wrote transmissions during the day, and at night I'd go to Cairo, Egypt, to check on the crystals that I had sent with Elizabeth. And it was during that period of time that I was trained by crystal masters as to what should be done with crystal power on the planet. You know, you just have to remember what happened with Atlantis to get a grip on what that responsibility level must have looked like. Because a great responsibility rests with anyone in charge of or in custody of certain kinds of crystals. Because of past misuse of them, entire civilizations have disappeared. I realized the seriousness of this crystal work and kept myself in balance for this special time in Cairo. So every night at 10 p.m., a spacecraft would bring me up, take me to crystal school in Egypt. Now, it was during this period of time that I started flashing and thinking about Shirley MacLaine. Her face would come and go in my mind, and I'd read something about her in the trade papers or see an old movie of hers on TV. I was stimulated to walk down to the corner payphone and call an old girlfriend of mine, Jeanette Browning. I hadn't even spoken to her in 3 years, yet I remembered that she'd been among the ones who sat around the round table in my kitchen while ETs had been coming and going throughout the house, so I wondered who she really was. Anyway, I called and invited her over to see me at Catalina. She told me that she was working for Shirley MacLaine as her secretary. Actually, Jeanette was Shirley's assistant while Shirley only played in Vegas. She never really went anywhere else with her. I first met Jeanette when she was dating and working for Robert Goulet. She had been in love with him, and she had loved to be around movie stars. She didn't want to be a star. She just wanted to walk in their shadows, so to speak. After I hung up the phone, a series of things started to happen. I felt this buzzing in my head. Time was distorted, and I was so hungry I could eat into tomorrow. I realized that the activation of the feminine energy was being activated within me, and that Shirley's energy some way, somehow, extended to me at Catalina, but I couldn't figure it out. I just shrugged it off as something weird and returned home to continue the transmissions. I had asked Jeanette to come over in about a week, as then I'd be through with my nightly visits to Cairo. But you know what? The very next day, Jeanette showed up unexpectedly with a very handsome man who later I first named the first lieutenant of the Prince of Darkness. When he walked through the door, my hair stood on end. He was gracious, friendly, but I could detect a frequency operating that really spelled out who he was. I couldn't tell Jeanette, as she was so naive in such matters. You know, she had the discernment of a worker ant, so I had to keep to myself what I was picking up on her friend. They invited me to dinner that night, and it was at dinner that I started really being tested. By whose forces? Well, just figure it out. It was not important to mention all the tests. The important thing is that I passed it. Because at 9:30, I promptly stood up, excused myself, and said that I had an important meeting that I had to attend. One of them wouldn't let me alone and kept insisting I stay and return with him to his boat. I kept walking and told him that I had an important meeting in Cairo. He said, "Egypt?" I said, "Yes." He called me crazy or some insane term and let me be. What this yo-yo didn't understand was that I really would be in Cairo, Egypt, by 10:05 and wouldn't return until 7 a.m. the next morning. I felt that all that had happened had been designed for me to see where my weaknesses and strengths were at that time. The thing that now stands out in my mind is that the date of this was Pleiadian lineup, November 17th, 18th, and 19th, the galactic days of activation that I have come to know so well. So no wonder I was being tested by the first lieutenant of the Prince of Darkness. By the next morning, I knew that I had passed the test. Yet, I knew that there would be other tests to see if I would remain true to the quest. A week later, around Thanksgiving, Thurman came to Los Angeles, and we got a room at the Hacienda Hotel, and it was close to the Los Angeles airport, and Elizabeth would be arriving back with the crystals at 2:30 a.m., the day before Thanksgiving, 1981. We picked her up, got the crystals, went back to the hotel. I wanted to just stay up and catch the helicopter back to Catalina so that we could have Thanksgiving at our house there. Besides, on Channel 5, they were having a Twilight Zone day from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. reruns of Rod Serling's stories. I really wanted to see that. Thurman said that he felt that we should stay at the hotel and not take the helicopter that morning. I grumbled, but agreed. At 8:30 a.m. that very morning, that helicopter crashed on its way to Catalina, dumping its passengers in the ocean. No one was killed. So Thurman was right about that one. When I look back at when things started going wacky, it was when Elizabeth brought the crystals back to me from Cairo. It seemed that there were forces that followed those crystals, or forces just hovering and monitoring what was going to happen with the crystals. All I know was that some kind of war had been declared on me personally, and it was because of my agreement to take responsibility for the crystals and their subsequent energies. When we returned to Catalina, I felt a feeling of doom approaching. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I felt like crying 5 or 6 times a day. This went on for 3 days. On November 29th, my galactic female friend who'd been living in my other pineal decided to bid me farewell. She had been my constant companion for 3 years. What was I ever going to do without her? She explained to me that she had to leave my energy field and that I needed a long rest. She had done what she could with Thurman through me, but she also knew that if she stayed, my nerves would burn out and I could possibly die. This news shook me to my foundation. What was I ever going to do without her? She'd become a great part of me. Her records were now part of my records, and vice versa. We'd made such a good team that the thought of such a drastic separation was devastating, to say the least. So, on November 29th, she explained that she'd be leaving in a couple of days. After the heavy transmission, she suggested that we take a walk to town. About 4 p.m., we walked down to get a newspaper. Everyone was talking about the death of Natalie Wood, the actress. I was stunned, numb. I couldn't believe my ears. My solar plexus started jumping. Tears came to my eyes. The news of her drowning was so shocking that I couldn't get my bearings. We walked back to the house, and I started washing dishes. I had to do something. I was crying and washing, crying and washing. I knew that something had gone wrong, for she was slated to be one of the beings with walk-in energies to come forth and help the planet by stepping forward and helping the people. I'd been told in one of the transmissions that I was supposed to meet her and that we had a lot of work to do together. I was from the same genetic cloning operation, and she was a part of me. I was devastated. What had gone wrong? I looked out my window and asked, "Is it time for me to leave the island?" At that moment, a big, I mean big, iced tea glass flew off the draining board, landed on the floor without breaking. In fact, it jumped off, and just before it got to the floor, it slowed down so it wouldn't break. I knew this was a signal to get the hell out of Dodge. Remember Dodge City and the train? Well, this is that moment. So the next morning, we started making plans to shut up the house. I had started having pains in my bladder. My nerves seemed shot, and in 2 hours, I was bleeding. I felt the sharp pain of a kidney stone, and I knew that feeling from 3 years before. I just now remembered that my galactic female friend arrived 1 month after my kidney stone operation in Florida. And now that she had left, I was experiencing another kidney stone. I wonder what this connection was. I had one more brief transmission about Natalie, explaining that she had lost her balance of reasoning and was an easy target for the dark forces that were monitoring her. I suffered emotional pain right along with her friends and family. My suffering was from another point of view. I knew who she really was, her potential, and what her assignment would be in helping to awaken the people. She would have gone down in Earth history as a woman who helped transmute millions out of spiritual darkness. She was a star maiden of galactic origin. She was a star from whence she came. And now she'd only be a memory of a famous movie star of Earth. What a loss. I suppose that this was my first real jolt about discernment. I knew that she had lost hers completely. A few years later, I discovered that there are certain types of people who have a genetic code of activation and that they have similar characteristics, like Natalie Wood, Elizabeth Taylor, Joan Collins, Suzanne Plachette, Elizabeth Ashley, etc., all have this same characteristic, and some have corresponding missions. And because of my coding, I did belong to this group. There are others connected to this mission who are not famous, but that doesn't lessen their importance on the planet. I realized that I had to get off of Catalina Island, and fast. I felt energies that were disruptive and alarming and that were entering my house. This was nuts. So, there was only one seat on the seaplane, so Thurman decided to take the boat. Every time I took a step, I was in pain. I waved to him as he went off on the boat. I called Gina Bilodeau, another star maiden trying to be an actress, movie star, to come pick me up, but she had an important meeting with an agent who hopefully would make her famous. I couldn't believe where her priorities were at that moment. Didn't she understand that I was bleeding and that I could be dying? She did, though, find someone else to pick me up. The whole episode was shocking. I was watching Thurman on the boat, but something made me turn around and see my luggage on top of a shuttle bus, and I yelled, "Where are you taking my luggage?" And it seemed that the seaplane had been canceled at the last moment, and everyone had boarded the bus to ride 20 miles up to the landing strip. I climbed aboard, took my seat, and decided that I'd use my mind to stop the kidney stone from moving. I succeeded and turned around and looked out the window. I saw the face of another star maiden friend of mine, Chris Griscom. I remembered her telling me how she had given birth to her baby alone, but with no help. And at that moment, I understood her dilemma of pain and being alone. I knew that if she could do it, that I could do it. And sure enough, I stopped that stone right in its track and also the pain. It seemed to take forever to get to the landing strip. When we got there, the pilot, who looked like a replica of Alan Ladd with a cigar in his mouth, told me that he had had the seaplane on the runway when a voice spoke to him and said, "Turn the plane around. It will never make it back." So with that, he turned the plane around and picked up the land plane. After he said that, I climbed on board, looked out the window, and then I saw Shirley MacLaine's face. It was then that I heard my inner voice say, "Oh, Shirley, Natalie's gone. It's now up to you to help the people on the planet." Well, where did that come from? I couldn't imagine why I would say such a thing. I hadn't even met Shirley yet, but something deep inside of me seemed to know. I did not know it then, but Warren Beatty, Shirley's brother, had been deeply in love with Natalie and was at that moment in deep sorrow and depression because of her untimely death. I was so relieved to arrive safely at Long Beach Airport. Thurman and I drove to LAX and flew directly to Las Vegas, where my best friend, Belva Bloomer, lived. She, as of this writing of this, wrote fan letters for Shirley up at Cripple Creek, Colorado. I knew in my heart that if I could get to my friend with her healing abilities, that we together could bust the kidney stones, and then I'd pass them. We made quite a team. She would hold the beam, and then I would shoot, and then try to pass them in the urine. And this went on for 5 or 6 days. I have never experienced so much pain. My nerves were raw. Natalie was dead, and where was my galactic female buddy? Gone. My personal world had collapsed, and I couldn't get a handle on what was really happening to me. Jeanette Browning, Shirley's secretary, asked me to come to her house to get well. I wasn't in a position to make many sound decisions, so I said yes. I stayed there from December 4th to the 16th. Jeanette had transiting Neptune on her natal sun, which kept her in the twilight zone most of the time. She couldn't turn around that she wasn't making some unwise decision, and looking back on those days, I felt kind of sorry for her. But later, I discovered that enemies come in many disguises. On one particular day, Thurman decided to show up and give me a gigantic healing with 2 giant crystals. Jeanette came home early to help. She had had several drinks and was sitting at my feet holding the point when the doorbell rang. It was flowers from the one she had been with in Catalina, the first lieutenant of the Prince of Darkness. She set them on the table downstairs, which is directly under my bed. There was an energy exchange set up, but I don't know to this day how to describe it with any clarity. But the energies coming from the crystals had aligned them with something that was killing me and not making me well. I knew it in the minute it happened, but I was too sick to know what to do. But I never will forget it. Never. I also realized that Thurman was playing the role of half-friend, half-villain. He should have been on top of the situation, but his ego got in the way and out of control, and he had absolutely no discernment. I knew that the energy trying to kill me also knew what my mission was to perform and simply did not want me to succeed. With naive Jeanette, and then Thurman playing acting his new role as God, I knew that I had to get out of there and fast. I wasn't thinking too well, but at least I knew that if I stayed that I might die. I know this sounds like I was filled with fear, but I was dealing with energies that were not of this world, and the test was too much to take because of my physical problem. Also around that time, I remember calling Chris Griscom. Thurman flew her there to Las Vegas. She worked on me, and I remembered her bringing some amethyst crystals and putting it in a glass of water, putting it in the sun, and all the purple left the amethyst. I drank the water, and somehow I was able to get my next energy up to where I could literally drive out of Las Vegas. I had Thurman drive me to Flagstaff, Arizona, where we had another house. I had 104 temperature for several days. And during my fever, I saw other dimensions and had many unusual visions. I encountered a being that reminded me, well, of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And I think it was him because I actually saw him later when he did leave the planet. It was the same guy. And others that looked like his assistants. Dark Star Lords were beaming energy constantly at me. I couldn't believe it. During this period of time, I talked to Jeanette, who wanted me to talk to Cha-Cha. And he'd been with Shirley for 2 or 3 years, training her in metaphysical matters. She called him David in her Out of the Book series, which is really a composite of 2 or 3 others who came to help her. And at that time, Cha-Cha was living off of Shirley's charity, so he was quite protective of any new people who would come into her life. He was doing drugs, drinking quite heavily. He'd had experiences with extraterrestrial beings, and he just couldn't function with ordinary humans. He had been with a female cosmonaut. She activated into him a lot of advanced knowledge, made love with him, and it spoiled him so much that he could never be satisfied by an Earth woman. He was a casualty of great spiritual indigestion. But now that I look back on it, I'm sure there was a runner, also from Ramsa, that was slowly but surely driving him away from Shirley and out of her life. Ramtha, well, this was his M.O. I told Cha-Cha that I had a screenplay to show him, hoping he would read it, and if he liked it, pass it on to Shirley. I had written a screenplay called It's Happened Again, the story of two souls out of body. They fall in love, then reincarnate back into body with the help from a spacecraft, a script that I heard from beginning to end in 45 minutes at Mount Charleston, Nevada, years before. In between training Thurman in cosmic laws and doing transmission, I developed the screenplay over 2.5 year period. I had a lot of help by celestial beings creating this screenplay, so I just assumed that everyone would welcome it with open arms. Boy, was I wrong about that. I was rejected from every corner of the film industry. So I felt it'd be proper to put it in Shirley's path in case she saw the potential of its birth on the screen. All this time, as Cha-Cha was reading the screenplay, I had dark Star Lords hovering over my bed. Was this some old past karmic debt playing out? Who were these energies trying to kill me? And if they kill me, then what? Then I didn't know or understand, but as the years passed with many more experiences and similar type of energies, I know that they were engaged by higher forces to test me, not to kill me. I knew I had a mission, and I knew that nothing, absolutely nothing, was going to stop me.
And we're so glad that it didn't. Here we are sitting all these years later, benefiting from your experiences, Lavendar. And that is our presentation for the evening. We will be back next week. And I want to thank you all for listening. Thank you to Fiona and Claudia. And have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.